some of the intellectual property fighting going on around, you know, there's lawsuits between companies like the New York Times and the AI companies. That's an example of what becomes almost higher stakes in a lot of ways when it comes to your health.
Today's conversation is one of my favorites. I sat down with Dr. Seth Feuerstein, the founder and CEO of We Therapeutics and a faculty member at Yale, to talk about a subject that's deeply important and often misunderstood, suicide. Dr. Feuerstein brings decades of clinical, academic, and entrepreneurial experience to the table, and what he shares in this episode might surprise you. We unpack why so much of what we think we know about suicide is actually wrong, and how those misconceptions are holding back progress and care. We cover a behavioral approach that reduces suicide attempts by 60%, the opportunity for AI-powered therapy, how outdated care models hold patients back, and so much more. Let's get into it. I'm really excited to have Dr. Seth Feuerstein here today as our guest. Dr. Feuerstein has an expertise across multiple areas of medicine, including suicide prevention, technology, suicide, social media, mental health, and digital health and therapeutics. Dr. Feuerstein teaches and is a faculty advisor for innovation in healthcare at the Yale School of Medicine. Most interestingly for us today, he's also an entrepreneur and has built at least two companies that I know of, Cobalt Therapeutics, a pioneer in digital mental health therapeutics, which he sold to Magellan, and more recently, We Therapeutics, which we will also discuss today. Dr. Feuerstein is also an advisor to Jiminy Health. We're really excited to have him involved and really excited to have him on the conversation today. So maybe we'll start with describing your professional career trajectory, which is not traditional, to say the least, for an MD. If you want to sort of walk us through that.
First of all, Mark, thank you for having me. It's good to spend the time with you. You know, my background is an unusual one. I would say that it mostly grew out of following different areas of interest where they led me and having a family that was flexible enough to allow me the freedom to do that, both my parents and my household today. Yeah, I did start out always planning to go to medical school, although in medical school quickly realized I thought I'd be an internist, actually. Traditional family practice probably wasn't for me. Got interested in intellectual property, university research. I also ended up getting a law degree because of my interests in genetics and genetic research back a long time ago when there were emerging legal issues, which has been handy in my entrepreneurial career, I think. But, you know, as I got into medical care and research, I started to really focus in on certain problems, and that pulled me into wondering what the solutions were for those problems. So I've had the luxury of being able to work across an academic ecosystem, a research ecosystem, a clinical ecosystem, and an entrepreneurial ecosystem. Over time, I have found I've been able to have a bigger impact on the entrepreneurial side in terms of the scaling and also the leverage of data to figure out what's working best for the most people. And then when you look at individual cohorts, you know, what works best on average, sometimes there are subpopulations where what works best for smaller groups or individuals is identifiable. We've been limited. And one of the wonderful things about mental health care is how inconsistent and variable, and in many cases, lousy care has been, either access to it or the quality of it. That creates huge opportunity, as does the fact that so much of it is delivered in conversation, which lends itself to the acquisition of massive amounts of data and distribution of interventions if you're not using chemical compounds or other means to do that. So while I am a psychopharmacologist by background, and I'm a big believer, and actually what drew me to psychiatry was the impact I saw medications having on extremely ill patients, I've become very interested in the huge volume of care delivered and the outstanding outcomes delivered with talk therapy, even though that's not what drew me into psychiatry originally.
It's a fascinating idea, this notion that we can cure people with words, right? Which is ultimately what we're doing with therapy and what Jiminy's primary focus is. And I know for some psychiatrists, that isn't really the focus. They work often alongside, say, a psychologist, et cetera. But interesting for you to have sort of had your hand in both.
Yeah, I got lucky. I mean, I would say I'm really lucky in the professional diversity I have. So I do a fair amount of board work. And some of those companies have massively scaled and so, you know, have been able to build teams and strategies to impact mental health care across literally hundreds of millions of benefit lives, which is a privilege and a unique opportunity.
It was probably, some of that was with Magellan, yes?
Some of it was with Magellan. Some of it was with a board that I came into to help them develop their strategy using text-based therapy. And we were successful in building data sets to convince all the health insurers to cover it. And this was now how most people like to communicate. And right. So getting coverage and scaling that and getting permission to get reimbursement from the insurers, which is really important in the U.S. healthcare system for distribution, worked really well, led to a good profitable business which on the business side led to a very large public offering, which isn't always what people want. But in this particular company's case, that was something they wanted. And interestingly, that led to the ability to have huge data sets and really look at what could work well, how could we leverage technology in texting. The work I did that Magellan acquired was actually using interactive videos. This is a long time ago. In fact, I'm probably dating myself if any listeners were even alive at the time when I would say the biggest reason our software wasn't working was because the DVDs were scratched, actually, in some of the interactive software we were using for things like insomnia and addiction. And one really important lesson during that period, which kind of went against the grain, was that, you know, in medical care, we tend to think about, well, what should we approve for condition X? And what we saw as we were starting to treat people at larger scale across areas like addiction was that, particularly with alcohol use disorder, in this particular case, we were looking at many different conditions, including a variety of addictions. The interventions worked really well. And there was a subgroup of alcohol use disorder patients in the addiction patient groups who would have never come to therapy, they said, if it was mandated that they had to do it live in a clinic. They expressed they didn't want to talk to people about it. There was a tremendous amount of shame. And so just accessing any useful care was only something they would consider if it was not delivered by a human.
That's fascinating. And of course, really relevant now in a world where everyone has a mobile phone and the ability to deliver care, whether it is in the form of videos or
about 18% of the patients who had alcohol use disorder said they would never have come to a clinic at all. And in that case, we saw about a 60% reduction in alcohol use in the treatment arm. So it mattered in terms of their outcome that they were accessing the technology. And I think it's an important example of why, you know, we need to be embracing appropriate technology that's properly validated and ethical during this exciting but also potentially risky new time.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that. There's something, another thread I want to pull on there. You mentioned earlier how important it was to deliver some of this via text because that's what people use. And I always think of this like the notion of sort of put the medicine in the water, right? You know, this is the delivery of fluoride. The easiest way to do it is to put it in the water or put your iodine in your salt. And if the way people are going to access something is via texting, and that's the medium in which they're most comfortable, if we can make something that is in fact safe and effective that uses the modality that people want to use, it's just...
Yeah, I have a funny anecdote that I'll call the other side of the coin about that. So... In mental health care, so anyone listening to this who's worked at a company knows that there's a lot of sensitivity about disclosing medical care generally to your colleagues. It could be some people are comfortable with it, some people aren't. It could be right. Cancer, it could be a stroke, could be a mental health condition. And after I had sold my company Cobalt to Magellan, now Centene, we were talking about confidentiality. And I said, well, you know, unlike oncology, where the appointments might be random and you may take a day off, like when you're going for talk therapy, the way it's structured is weekly. And so we may pretend like it's confidential. But if you go to your boss and you say, I need every Thursday afternoon off, because let's be honest, at that time, there was no virtual care. It meant you had to travel to the appointment. You had to sit with the person. You had to leave. So you had to take a half day off.
Right.
Who's going to go to their boss and say, well, I need a half day off forever or for the next 8 weeks or 12 weeks to go through a cognitive behavioral therapy program, whatever. And their boss is not going to know what it is.
Right.
It was a farce that people had confidence. You know, so there was no wonder people weren't accessing care, even if it was available to them for issues that were important and needed medical attention. So,
well, actually, that points out that's a whole other thread to pull on, which is sort of the access to care. One of the things I've always thought, we don't have enough therapeutic care and enough mental health and behavioral health care in the United States for all the people who struggle with anxiety, depression, let alone serious mental illness. Many reasons for that. But one of the other issues for access isn't just about, are there enough therapists? It's also about like, can I take the time to do it? And it's only an affluent knowledge worker who's like, yes, I'm just going to take Tuesdays at 10 off every week forever. And my boss is going to be cool with that because otherwise they got to backfill me. And I don't know, I'm a machine learning engineer. And so they're not going to say no. That's just not how it works in the real world. And for most jobs, you just can't do it. And so one of the things that I think is really interesting is new modalities that are allowing people to have access to therapy in off hours, or at least if I can do it virtually, then I don't have the travel time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe it's 45 minutes instead of an hour and a half out of my week. So switching gears here a little bit, a lot of your work has been on suicide and suicidality. And I've heard some of your other talks. And first of all, I just would love to hear sort of your conversation, you sort of describing the biology of suicide, suicidality. It's very different than a lot of people think. I think even my own sort of understanding of it is like, it's an extreme form of depression. Like, and it appears that it's not, and I'm not going to do it justice. So anyways, I'd love to hear sort of talking about the work that's been done there and then what the implications are for treatment modalities.
I do love talking about it, so feel free to cut me off. Part of the reason I love talking about it, even though it's a troubling topic in many ways, is that I accidentally ended up focusing on suicide. It's not what drew me into psychiatry. Suicide attempts, suicidality, and suicidal deaths are actually incredibly common. And yet, I have not been directly touched by it through a close relative or close friend, which is unusual. Most people actually have been. I got really interested in it almost exactly 10 years ago. Obviously, I treated patients who were suicidal. I was interested in it in a sort of general way. But I read a paper that really sent me down a rabbit hole to sort of look at the data. And I realized a few things. The first is that we start hearing about suicide when we're very young. Usually young children are starting to be exposed to the concept of, you know, even if it's just joking about killing themselves.
Right.
Even if it's not serious, like, oh, I'll kill myself if that happens. They don't mean it. That has some effects. And some of those effects are prejudices and biases around like, well, what is it? What does it come from? And historically, going back thousands of years, suicide was most closely associated with deep melancholy, like the classic descriptions that go back thousands of years around dark, depressed states. Now, it's true that a significant percentage of people who think about suicide or attempt suicide probably have major depressive disorder. It's probably at least 15 to 20% and maybe as high as 30 to 33% or so. But it is not true that most people who attempt or think about or die by suicide have major depressive disorder. Depression is kind of a risk factor, but because so much of the traditional literature and even people like Freud, the patients that they saw knew had melancholia or major depressive disorder, it's closely associated with that.
Even well, the sort of literature tropes, like I imagine, like, I don't know, Celia Plath or like people with very, very melancholy, right? Melancholy, Churchill's black dog, what have you, and then sort of like wandering into the ocean. And as you say, the data doesn't support that.
Yeah. I mean, most people who attempt or die by suicide do not have major depressive disorder. That's pretty clear in the data. You know, probably about a third have no other medical condition other than their suicidality. Probably about up to a third have major depressive disorder, and probably about a third have some other medical diagnosis. Could be another disease of the brain like schizophrenia, bipolar, or Parkinson's. Could be a cancer diagnosis or something else that's increasing their risk. And the model that I've developed for myself to really think about it, and I guess this is because I'm classically trained. I did my medicine year as an intern after medical school before doing my psychiatry residency, is really cardiac arrhythmias are actually the model I like to use. I landed on that for myself. I hadn't really heard about it anywhere else. But to me, and this may have been what you were referring to, I try to describe the way I think about it, having now spent 10 years really obsessed with this problem, is that the cardiac arrhythmia state of the heart is a somewhat spontaneous period of risk of sudden death. The likelihood of it is increased if you have other diseases of the heart, right? So like if you've had a heart attack, or if you have some other disorder of the vascular.
It doesn't help you have diabetes or hardened arteries.
Yeah, but there are a lot of medical conditions that increase your risk. By the way, drugs of abuse increase your risk of an arrhythmia, just like they increase the risk of getting suicidal. And so that model fits better because lots of people who have arrhythmias, they don't have any other medical conditions. And if you look at the risk factors of arrhythmias broadly, they're the same risk factors as they are for major depressive disorder, drugs of abuse, other diseases of the organ, family history, et cetera. What that means is that a lot of the symptoms and related things associated with depression are not actually that closely associated. And what we're seeing in the literature is that suicidal thinking and suicide attempts are actually not that closely linked. You obviously can't have an attempt if you've never had the thought because you have to actually think it to do it. But there are a significant proportion of people who attempt or die by suicide who only have had that thought at the moment they attempt or die. And there are people who think about it all the time and have almost no risk of ever having an attempt. And we've not done a good job of thinking about how to differentiate those two. Data, especially over the last 7 or 8 years, is increasingly showing that. And the interventions I got interested in, I read a paper about 10 years ago that showed you can reduce suicide attempts by about 60% by not focusing on ideation, instead focusing just on the way the brain is reacting to the world, on the behaviors that that leads to, and on training that individual, in some ways almost like physical therapy around the problem. Like, what do you do if these certain things happen? How do you decrease the risk? What shocked me, and I think is emblematic of some broad issues in the mental health care system and in our healthcare system generally, but in particular in our mental health care system, is that this particular approach was first published 20 years ago in the Journal of the American Medical Association. At that time, they showed about a 50% reduction in attempts. And I had never seen a patient receive it. I did not know of a single faculty member at Yale or any other institution who was aware of it or delivering it. And I was now a senior executive at a health insurer with 100,000 network clinicians who are either social workers, psychologists, or psychiatrists.
And none of them.
And I couldn't find a single clinician who delivered this intervention.
You know, Seth, this is probably a longer conversation than we could have today, but it is very frustrating. You can find this throughout the health system where best practices are understood. They're published in the highest impact journals with the right KOL, the right RCT to prove it, et cetera. And then the behavior doesn't actually change. I mean, we've seen this with like colonoscopy prep, which is still this extremely onerous thing. And then they established that it didn't actually need to be. And nobody made the change. And by the way, the consequences are real because as a result, lots of people don't get colonoscopies. And then they die of colorectal cancer that was completely preventable.
That's a fabulous fabulous analogy.
And I spent a lot of time in oncology. I could give you 50 examples like this that exist inside the oncology world. And there's a longer conversation to have about sort of status quo bias in the health system and the fact that most clinicians are reasonably conservative by nature. They know what they were taught in medical school. Also, they're taught to be conservative. And so anyways, changing behavior is hard.
It's hard. You know, there's two things that makes me think of. One is it's part of why the entrepreneurial piece is so interesting to me, because what's unfortunate but true is that aligning financial incentives does lead to that change. And if you can figure out how to do that, if you have financially incentivized all the clinics to change the prep, they would do it.
It would happen very quickly. It'd be amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, the second is that in particular, I believe that this mismatch in suicide is probably the biggest gap between the data and the outcomes that we see in all of healthcare. And I say that because suicide is the second leading cause of death for people from their teens into their mid-20s.
It makes me think about even sort of public health issues. So I was always shocked by how long it took San Francisco to put netting around the Golden Gate Bridge. Just a very particular example, it's sort of like a suicide hotspot was for forever. The number of people, I mean, it was astonishing and awful, the number of people who killed themselves every year at Golden Gate Bridge. And my suspicion, this is just a hunch, but that part of that was there's sort of this sense that these are people, they're all struggling with major depression. If they don't kill themselves today at the Golden Gate Bridge, it's going to happen tomorrow somewhere else. And so putting up a netting for $10 million, like we're just kicking the can down the road a few days. And of course, that's not what the data say, right? But that's what's sort of in the air for people who don't understand any better, because I can't imagine if you had a road where literally hundreds of people died every year taking a corner. And what you had to do was like, let's put up some better guardrails and straighten the thing out and we will save hundreds of lives. I mean, people do this all the time to save, you know, one or two lives a year. Like, this is a dangerous intersection. And yet the Golden Gate Bridge had no netting until very recently. And people have known this for, I think the work you're doing to help people sort of understand the nature of this turns out to have really important implications, not just in care, but in things like public health policy and all the rest of it. I'm curious, this analogy to arrhythmia, is it actually a sort of physiological thing? Like one of the things I was thinking when I heard you talk about that is like, so does that mean things like transcranial stem, like where we can sort of change the, how far can we extend this analogy?
So I think that that would be hard. So what's interesting is the relatively spontaneous part. Like if you were going to do TMS, right, you'd have to actually be wearing
a helmet, right,
and kick on. So it's kind of like putting a pacemaker in.
Yeah.
Will we one day get there? I actually think one day we will. And by that, I mean, once you've had an attempt, you're always at significant risk. You're about 40 times as likely to have an attempt as the general population. That's not unlike a lot of different cardiac arrhythmias. And so what do? We've developed hardware with software in it. And can I see one day that that'll be the case? Probably in some way. On the other hand, that's not going to happen in the short term, right? So, you know, to me, the arrhythmia really comes from the brilliant work. There's someone named Aaron Timbeck, to those who really knew him. And he actually was involved in the therapy that I spent my time digitizing early days and sort of envisioning it. He's since passed, but he developed a terminology for something called the suicide mode. And it's like this arrhythmia-like mode of the brain. And he's really just had massive impact across many parts of psychiatry. And so he's considered the father of cognitive behavioral therapy, for instance, in the US. And so, you know, what Tim described, or Aaron described, was that in these patients that he interacted with, their brain was in this mode where it actually wasn't functioning properly. And it was so if you've known of people, whether from the popular media, like famous people who've attempted or died by suicide, you probably say to yourself, oh, they had everything going for them. Right. Why would they do that? And the reason is that their brain's not functioning properly. It's kind of like when your computer freezes up.
Right.
And it's very frustrating for you when your computer freezes up, but you like, you know, and I don't know if I've ever said this to you, Mark, but the way I described it to people was like, you kind of like, there's that restart button and you push it and you kind of push it really hard. Like you don't have to push it really hard. You could just gently hold down the start button until your computer restarts, but you don't. Because you're so frustrated. So now imagine if your entire brain was locked up like that.
Right.
And a related piece of information is, you know, when people attempt or die, people are like, why would they choose to do that? But to say, why would they choose? This is an example of the prejudices. And clinicians say this and psychiatrists say this, but they don't see a choice.
Right.
So a choice implies you see two different
things.
Everybody
says, why did you choose to have a heart attack? Right.
That's exactly right. It would be like saying, why'd you choose to have an arrhythmia or a heart attack? It just happened. Yeah. And by making it feel like it's a choice. Now, what you can do is train them to sit out that period, or like in the old movie theaters when they would say stop, drop, and roll. Like, what can we do that's an automatic style thing, right, that increases the likelihood that if they don't see any choices, we've now given their brain something that's such a simple out from that mode that they can get through it, because it is time limited. The suicide mode is not permanent. And if you talk to people who've attempted and had serious attempts, almost all of them say the same thing, which is, I didn't want to die.
Well, there's a fascinating documentary somebody made, to go back to the Golden Gate Bridge, about people who had survived suicide attempts off the Golden Gate Bridge. And if you jump off the Golden Gate Bridge, this is not a cry for help. You are trying to kill yourself. I mean, because the vast majority of people who do, they will die. But some of them survive. Every once in a while, somebody does. And of course, they've studied them. And many of them go on to be very happy, right? Have full, rich, fulfilled lives and not attempt suicide again and hopefully done the hard work to prevent this sort of brain state coming back on, or if it does, having an exit path, as you're describing it, that is effective for them. Another piece of that I want to sort of pull into this, suicide rates have gone up. I think there's lots of different reasons potentially for that. One of the things I've heard you talk about in other forums is the notion of digital bombardment of our brain as an ongoing stressor. And that like part of what I can almost imagine, like ending up in a bad state is easier when there is sort of too much stress in the brain. And so one of the things, I mean, I'm very curious about this in particular, you know, I work, Jiminy is a company that is trying to deliver care through mobile phones in part because everyone has one and you bring the care to where people live. Also, I think we want people to not use their mobile phone so much. And I'm curious about sort of the data there and kind of what you've seen.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty well established at this point that for a significant proportion of individuals, constant digital bombardment, whether it's notifications or spending time in certain applications, increases distress levels for significant proportions of large subpopulations of our society. And I think this has even been admitted in congressional testimony by some of the CEOs of some of those.
Well, and it's been I think it's been studied quite extensively. Actually, our advisors, both Lyle Unger at Penn and Johannes Eichstadt here at Stanford and others, I think have done a lot of work to sort of cut the data, look at both everything from usage to like how are people using. And it's not just social media, but sort of general phone usage, et cetera.
And I think what's really hard for people is to figure out what are the things that are distressing them. It's very hard to do that for a lot of people. And, you know, when we were talking about suicide, this is relevant generally to all of our organs, okay? We could talk about the kidney or the lung. There are just things that traumatize them, right? Like if I'm breathing in a lot of smoke, it's going to hurt my lungs that like I'm going to have a hard time breathing and I'm going to want to take a break from that environment.
Constantly dehydrated, not so good for my kidneys.
Yeah. Like if I'm walking all day, let's just say that walking is pretty easy, but if you do too much walking, eventually your legs just get fatigued. And if you keep doing it after they're fatigued, you're eventually going to fall and hurt yourself. Right. You know, it could be your ACL. If you're playing tennis, you may tear it if you just keep working it too much. And the brain is no different. And by the way, you'll notice, I always like to go back to medical analogies so that people don't pretend like it's something unique. The brain is pretty much the same as these other organs. It's right. Just that the traumas are a little bit different. So
for example, if your three-year-old is waking you up two or three times a night, repeatedly for weeks on end, that might induce a little bit of trauma. Asking for a friend.
Yeah, exactly. I've been there and... luckily, I had a partner who took care of a lot of that when I was on call and such, because I was a resident at the time. But that's a great example. Imagine an alarm is just going off every hour, every night. And I think some people, they have notifications on their phone. They're dealing with that. If this is helpful context, I usually go in airplane mode and plug my phone in another room at 8 p.m. and don't look at it again.
My favorite consumer products, I don't know if it ever actually took off. Ariana Huffington started a business a number of years ago, sort of related to general wellness. And she was very public about talking about her own sort of, I don't know if it was a nervous breakdown, it's the language one uses, but like she hit a wall, exhaustion, et cetera, at some point. And you can imagine she running a variety of amazing business. Anyway, so she started a company to help. And the very first product they built was a little bed for your mobile phone. You put your mobile phone to bed and like there's space for the whole family. So mom's phone, dad's phone, the kid's phone. And at 9 p.m. or whatever, everybody goes, puts their phone there and that's it. I think it's really problematic actually in some ways that some of these apps that you feel like you have to have, like my alarm clock is on my phone, right? And my nanny cam to watch the three-year-old is on my phone. And so it doesn't feel possible for me to actually disconnect from the device, but then it's always there.
Look, I won't out this person, but I say this. So I know someone who uses Follow My iPhone for their children. I won't say whether I live with them or not.
Yeah.
And I'm constantly saying to them, when has anyone ever helped their kid out with like, the comment will be like, well, what if their car breaks down? I'll be like, well, then they'll call AAA or they'll call us. Like, what am I going to do if they're in Wisconsin and their car breaks down? I don't know why that feature, but people love that. That's one example of thousands of features that, whether it's by intent or by accident, hijack some of the wiring of the way we crave certain things. And so now, to be fair, the only time I plug my phone in and keep it next to me at night is when I'm traveling for work and I'm in a hotel. I use it as my alarm clock because the alarm clocks are so terrible in all those hotels and unreliable. Right. And you know what? Sometimes if I'm having trouble sleeping, I do the worst thing, which is I'll be like, I'll check my email at 3 a.m.
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, there are worse. You go check Instagram or TikTok or something that is algorithmically designed to sort of keep you engaged. It'd be even worse. But so maybe switching gears here a little bit. I'm curious, you spend a lot of time in the sort of entrepreneurial ecosystem at the intersection of sort of technology, mental behavioral health, and new businesses that are thinking about ways to improve all the challenges we have in mental behavioral health, efficacy, with access, with cost, et cetera. Where are areas, you know, in terms of AI meets healthcare and bio that are sort of, you think are underestimated or overestimated? What are you sort of most excited about over the next few years?
So talk therapy is one of the most exciting areas because generative content is inherently language,
right?
Today, for the most part. And so that may change. But right now we think of generative content as mostly language driven, and that's how mostly it's being rolled out today. That's a unique opportunity because there's so much bad talk therapy that it's a pretty low-hanging area to improve things. Now, that can work in multiple ways. You know, your listeners probably don't spend as much time as the two of us do thinking about these problems. So, like, you know, one of the areas that gets the most attention in healthcare is just helping with better medical note-taking. But the most exciting areas are either helping better train and provide feedback to live clinicians, to humans as an augmented tool, or to provide additional tools to patients for clinicians that can actually enhance the quality and efficacy of their care. And I think it's inevitable within a year or two, and there are already companies raising a lot of financing to do this for purely generative AI therapy tools that sit kind of outside the traditional therapy structure. So you've got this continuum, right, of all these things AI can start to do, whether it's helping clinicians be better, doing things for clinicians with their patients, or in some cases, and I think it's inevitable, and the American Psychological Association actually just went to the FTC about generative therapy bots that are being marketed, and it's been broadly covered in, you know, publications like the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times around people. These bots are calling themselves therapists.
They're calling themselves therapists, yeah. And representing themselves, and they're like in fine print, maybe we're not actually a therapist.
It's a huge opportunity for progress, but it's actually, if we do it right, it'll mean being really thoughtful about ethical principles and transparency, and hopefully the medical and psychological professional organizations will really take the lead rather than be responsive. I'd rather they don't react and instead sort of be proactive.
I think, you know, the self-driving car in the AV world is an interesting example, because I was at the Singularity Summit here on the Stanford campus. I don't know what it was, 17 years ago, when the first, like, hey, the car made it through the desert, and everybody was like, great, we're going to have self-driving cars in a few years. It's upon us now. I mean, you can take a Waymo in San Francisco, and it is astonishing. And, you know, I think in the next 4 or 5 years, we will see sort of massive deployment of self-driving cars. It took a while. And part of that was that you need to get it right. And I think that the same thing is true in a therapeutic context. The consequences of delivering poor therapy, saying the wrong thing, you know, the alignment challenge is real. And so what I agree with you, Seth, my hope for this is that people, companies will be responsible, work very closely with their psychology and psychiatric and psychological sort of counterparts to make sure that what they're rolling out is treatment appropriate, overseen, et cetera. Not just like, hey, let's move fast and break things. It's just not the right way to do things in healthcare.
Completely agree. And it's funny because I've been saying over the next few years or 5 years, you know, you said 17 years ago you were at that Singularity meeting. It's interesting because I think the Human Genome Project took 18 years, and I used that as an example about 7 years ago. You know, when you think about a company like Amazon, which has now transformed so much of our retail lives and content, you know, innovation cycles in some ways, you know, it takes about half the time to get to about 1% penetration. I read somewhere a long time ago, and they used the Human Genome Project as an example. And then it takes the other half of the time to do the other, like 90 to 99%.
Well, yes. These things tend to be exponential. And, you know, the doublings, you don't feel the doublings when the numbers are very small, et cetera. What's happening with AI and generative AI specifically is happening faster than anything I've ever seen in my career. I mean, I happen to have been very, very early. I built a consumer internet company in 1994. I built a mobile company in 2003. Helped build a genomics business as NGS was being introduced, or, you know, 2013-ish timeframe. So we've seen things moving fast before. I've never seen anything like what's happening with AI now. Now, again, this in some ways, this took 50, 60, 70, people have been talking about AI since Marvin Minsky, and I have scars from a class I took with Barbara Gross back in 1989, where the only thing, it was an AI class, and all I remember from that class was like, this will never actually work. We hit a point where it does work, and already generative AI can add tremendous value in all kinds of different contexts.
Yeah, I should have said in highly regulated industries, I think it takes longer. So, and what's interesting is...
In high consequence, where if you provide an answer back to a white collar worker who's like, give me a bunch of ideas for a report I'm writing, and I can reject three of them as lousy and take four that are good and use it to help craft a thing, there's no consequence to the fact that the specificity was moderate. With something where I'm delivering care to somebody who is sick, it can't be 100% right because human beings aren't right either, but you need it to be right most of the time. Yeah.
And in some ways, I wish self-driving cars was faster. Areas like radiology, I wish we were using more AI because I know people would be doing better. And I'm sure it'll come out more slowly in mental health care, but there's these interesting tension. And just to give a concrete example to anyone who's eventually listening to this, you know, let's imagine you're Google and you've got a couple hundred thousand employees that you're responsible for the health benefits of. Well, if your Gemini products are the back engine of some talk therapy bot, like, what does it mean if that's powering the mental health care for your employees, where like there's supposed to be some wall in between, but theoretically that data is flowing into, like, you know,
right.
They're all.
So even, yes, even the privacy issues alone are, I mean, I think the simplest version of that is, that with any mental behavioral health app, you better make sure that there is no data flowing back to like a foundational model, and there's no possibility.
I think some of the intellectual property fighting going on around, you know, there's lawsuits between companies like the New York Times and the AI companies. That's an example of what becomes almost higher stakes in a lot of ways when it comes to your health.
Right.
Not that the New York Times issues and other publications, it's not a high stakes issue.
No, but there's nothing more high stakes than like PHI, right? A massive broad scale HIPAA violation, or, you know, some foundation model was being trained on the deepest, darkest thoughts of somebody who thought they were having a confidential therapeutic conversation, would be an absolute disaster. And this goes back to what you said earlier, Seth. I do think it's troubling that some companies that are consumer facing and are not providing clinical grade care are sort of presenting themselves as if they are. It's one thing to say, hey, talk to my chatbot. Cool. Talk to the chatbot. It's a different thing to sort of have something that is presented as a therapist. I will say this, though. The latent demand for this is so tremendous.
Absolutely.
That it reveals several things. One, that we have the sort of access issue for therapy is tremendous in the US, right? I don't know what the numbers are. On the order of 50 million people who've been diagnosed with, say, garden variety anxiety, and there's only 250,000 therapists in the country. You can do the math. There's just not enough therapists to provide care, let alone for all the folks with serious mental illness. So, and what's happening is...
Let me give you food for thought on that.
Yeah,
in
yeah,
the
please.
US. So I'm going to use fintech as an analogy. When you look at banking or cell tower, you know, the switch to high-speed data like LTE, when you look at African nations or you look at India, where they didn't have a lot of traditional infrastructure for banking or for telecommunications, they leapfrogged.
Sure. Everybody had a mobile phone like that, and everybody had LTE. Yeah.
In the U.S., it took us longer to transfer. Now, in the U.S., we have about one psychologist for every couple thousand people in the U.S., like maybe 3,000 people. In India, they have, I think, one psychologist for every like 1.2 million people. So when you've got we say we can't scale people. When you literally only have one PhD level therapist for over a million people, you can't pretend you're going to scale human workers.
Right.
You have to jump levels like happened in telecommunications and banking. And so we may see a lot of rapid progress occurring in countries where they really don't have a choice because
there's literally sort of no mental behavioral health infrastructure. It's a really interesting point. And, you know, in many cases, all your sort of mobile phone and LTE rollout it's ultimately actually a benefit. These societies have been able to advance so quickly in that way. That does require, of course, then that you have a technology that scales and is effective, which is you know, a challenge for all of us who are working in the field. Anything else that you're most excited or scared about with LLMs and sort of the rise of AI in healthcare?
I mean, this is, you know, obviously you mentioned I spend time with you and Lewis and others at Jiminy. I think, you know, I've been impressed by the incredible focus on ethics and transparency that you're trying to take. I think that that's an issue that can't be discussed too much for two reasons. One, because of the importance of it, but also because I don't think people have a deep appreciation and understanding of some of the problems that can get created. And so it's going to require a lot of discussion for the crystallization and nuggets around what's important to trickle through to all the various stakeholders, whether it's the electronic medical record companies or the patients or the providers or the professional associations. And so, you know, that's an area that really, you know, needs more discussion and hopefully will. Look, I'm particularly excited to see what happens overseas, as I just referenced with the India comment, because I think we're going to start to see, it'll take a few years, but we're going to start to see really thoughtful and widespread new models of care. And there was just, you know, I don't know if I should or shouldn't name the publications, but, you know, in a publication we've already mentioned, the popular publication, the news publication, they just had a description of the ways AI is being rolled out in China. Mm-hmm. And for crisis lines, it was one of them. And when you think about it, like in China, they're never going to have enough people to man the crisis line.
Right.
And, you know, in the U.S., we've had this ambitious 988 rollout. It's a very traditional infrastructure. It's very traditional U.S. style. And that's an area where, you know, we don't have enough people. They're not all masters.
Well, and even if all you're using the AI for is for triage to figure out who can have a conversation with an AI, because it's not actually that acute and the AI can handle the sort of situation that they're dealing with, versus who really needs to talk to somebody right now. And if we have limited staffing, we're going to make sure that that person gets to somebody who's highly trained, like, you know, yeah. Right
on
away.
On the flip side, I was in my kitchen yesterday and I was asking Siri to call someone, which gives away that I'm an Apple product. And I had acquired an Apple HomePod speaker, not for music actually, because I had to have something to make this Apple HomeKit work.
Right.
Either an Apple TV or that. So I bought that. And I actually, it started speaking back to me. I was talking to my phone, but the speaker. So like, it's an example of some of the technical things that need to be figured out. But a week earlier, someone was in my apartment talking about a clinical case and mentioned the word suicide. And the HomePod speaker said, and we were not discussing it about ourselves, said, if you are in crisis, just out of the blue, said, if you are in crisis and you are feeling like you're at risk, call 988. It gave the information about that. So it's interesting we're having this conversation today. The speaker's been in the kitchen for about 2 months. That's never happened before.
Isn't so interestingly, yeah, so far my Alexa that is in the room has not reacted, nor has Siri, but who knows? That's fascinating. And we'll see where that all goes. Side note, if you happen to be reading Harry Potter to your 9-year-old on your Kindle, on your phone, and you, every time you say the name Sirius Black, who is a character in Harry Potter, it wakes up. Seth, I really enjoyed the conversation today. I'll close with one final question for you, which is, have you read anything or watched anything or listened to anything recently that you think is particularly interesting that you'd like to recommend to people? Great book, great podcast, great blog, sort of, you know, related to the topics that we've discussed today.
So there's someone I admire who I know a little bit, and she wrote a book. She's a psychologist and a professional poker player and really smart. Her name is Annie Duke. And she wrote a book called Thinking in Bets. And I read it. It was given to me. And I actually kind of knew a lot of what was in it, but I thought her framing and the way I knew brilliant decision makers who used similar frameworks, but just automatically. And so I would highly recommend it for people, both because
she has another book as well, which is sitting on my bedside table, which is How to Quit, I think it's similar themes. As a professional poker player, of course, the art of poker is knowing when to fold them, which is most of the time. It's very interesting because she pulls in a lot of the sort of, you know, thinking fast and slow, notions of loss aversion, et cetera, and some of our core heuristics for how we think about when to start or stop things, which are probably driven by our evolutionary history, are not always actually sort of algorithmically like the best way to think about really important choices in your life. And in particular, about when to stop doing something. And she talks a lot about like your stick-to-itiveness. We talk a lot about that. And like, yes, it's very useful to have grit and to have stick-to-itiveness, et cetera. It's also useful to understand like, this job's not working out or this relationship is never going to work. And it's actually time, like life is short. And so it's time to move on. I love that somebody with her background in particular is sort of with professional poker.
And most people don't realize she started out as like a PhD psychology person.
Yeah, no, you read the book though, and it comes through pretty quickly. Yeah.
And I guess the other thing, Daniel Kahneman recently passed away and actually physician assisted suicide, interestingly.
Yeah.
And went overseas to do that. There's another book that people don't talk about that much it's both because Michael Lewis has written so many books people talk about a lot. And when people talk about Kahneman, they talk about thinking fast and slow.
Right.
But Michael Lewis wrote a book called The Undoing Project.
Yeah.
And I would recommend that to people because as I think about it, this just occurred to me as we're talking.
Yeah.
But there are so many, Michael Lewis is such a great writer.
Yeah, I'd read anything he'd write, first of all. Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, the themes of undoing relate a lot to suicide. And there's a lot of undoing to do around the way people think about the disease state and condition. And maybe this is some interesting food for thought. In my first interactions with the FDA around what we're trying to do at WE, it took us about a year to convince them it was something that we should be targeting. They viewed suicide as something in our conversations that was like a risk factor and side effect from medications and drug trials. And there's even a debate within the medical profession around whether it's a disease state and should be included in things like the DSM. So, but the Undoing Project, and actually, it to me is a great, more popular version of Thinking Fast and Slow as a book to read. I would really encourage people to read it because obviously Michael Lewis is great.
Yeah, Michael Lewis can make anything interesting, and it's shorter than Thinking Fast and Slow too. Although Thinking Fast and Slow, I literally for years, I would buy it for every single new employee who worked with me, especially on anything sort of product related. I think it's an incredibly important book and collection of sort of understanding human nature in a lot of core ways. But that's a great recommendation. Seth, this was so much fun. Thank you.
Thanks. It was a lot of fun. Thanks, Mark. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Neural Compass, the Jiminy podcast. If today's conversation sparked something for you, follow us at Instagram, YouTube, or LinkedIn, or explore more at jiminyhealth.com. At Jiminy, we're building the future of mental health care with effective, safe, AI-enabled continuous care. See you next time.